Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is In Brief. My guest tonight is Emily Thomas. She is associate professor in philosophy at Durham University, and we're talking about her new book, The Meaning of Travel, Philosophers Abroad. Emily, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you about this book.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
One of the things I love about many things that I love about this book is it begins and ends with these sort of weird historical philosophical travel tips. So at the beginning, there's 10 tips for traveling well that includes, and this is my favorite, number 3, consider the monsters.
I read enormous quantities of vintage books giving advice on how to travel. And this is the kind of thing that you find. Avoid the sea monsters. Make sure you don't get eaten.
See, I would look for the sea monsters. I wouldn't you look for the sea monster?
Yeah, I would definitely be looking for the sea monsters. I think without a doubt. But I wonder if I really thought they were real, perhaps then I would be avoiding them.
Well, and at the end, there's returning home, including Descartes. Ensure that you've not traveled too long. Did they think if you traveled too long, you would lose your essential wherever you come from? Like that would be gone?
Yeah, I think that was exactly the worry, that you might stop being French in Descartes' case. And you certainly hear people who travel so long that when they come home, they find it hard to re-enter their home place. And I think that's the kind of worry that he's getting at.
Now, this is a fascinating book, and it really sort of traces the history of philosophers talking about and traveling, but it's also a story of your trip to Alaska.
It is, yeah. I spent a few weeks wandering around Alaska, and I was writing the book whilst I was there, and the two things became inextricably tangled in my mind. I love Alaska, by the way. If you haven't been already, then after the lockdown, I strongly suggest people visit it.
It is huge. It's a big wild place. But you know, you just brought this up and you talk about this in your book. Why is travel tangled up with philosophy? Why are so many philosophers that you quote, why are they talking about travel and the importance of travel?
So the philosophy of travel is not a thing. There aren't lecture courses on this. There aren't textbooks or guides to it.
Yet, I
agree. Hopefully in the not too distant future. But when I began looking into the relationship between philosophy and travel, I discovered that they have been moving in and out of each other's orbits for centuries. And in Western philosophy, this was really kick-started by the Age of Discovery. So right. In the 16th, 17th centuries, you have these sailors and merchants wandering off around the globe. They're seeking new trade routes, even new lands to colonize. And philosophers at home begin thinking about travel and what that might mean for our understanding of the world. And what you end up with is this interrelationship developing. So aspects of travel begin affecting philosophy. And then as philosophers get going, aspects of philosophy begin affecting travel.
Did historical philosophers travel themselves extensively? No, you sort of imagine them, they're sitting in some garret just thinking big thoughts. But the great thing about your book is you point out that philosophers traveled.
Yeah, they did. So there are certainly some famous philosophers who did not travel. Socrates famously says that you can lead me all over Greece just by waving the pages of a book in front of me. And he was very proud of the fact that he never left Athens. And the other philosophers have wandered all over the place. So during the 17th century, for example, many philosophers acted as bear leaders. They were taking young noblemen on the grand tour. And they include really well-known people like Thomas Hobbes, John Locke.
Wow.
And they're just wandering around Europe. Descartes was such a vagabond that as an adult, he never lived more than a couple of weeks in the same city. He was constantly moving on.
One of the central things that when philosophers write and talk about traveling is this idea of otherness. Can you expand on what that means?
I can. So the other is whatever is unfamiliar to you. And I think that We are often in search of the other, of the unfamiliar when we travel. That's one of the big things that drives us into the world to leave our homes behind. We want to understand things that are new to us. And what is other to me is going to be different to what is other to everyone else, just because all of us have our own backgrounds, our own set of memories and so on. So me visiting Alaska as a British person, I imagine I'm going to have a very different experience to someone, you know, coming from New York or Massachusetts.
And it's fascinating when they start sort of discerning the difference between everyday journeys and travel journeys. Has to do with the amount of otherness.
That's what I think is going on. So some people argue that there's a big distinction to be drawn between going traveling in the grand sense and then mere tourism. And I actually am very doubtful there is such a distinction. I think that all travel is a tourist, really. But what I do think we can identify are trips that contain bigger amounts of the unfamiliar, of the other, than other trips. So for me, if I go on a holiday to France, there's going to be some unfamiliar stuff there, but there's not going to be lots. I'm European. I'm fairly familiar with French culture. In contrast, if I visit China, I'm going to find lots that's unfamiliar to me. And so then I think we'd be tempted to say that my trip to China was travel, whereas my trip to France was just tourism.
That's fascinating. That's really fascinating. It seems that travel then is getting harder and harder to do as the world becomes more homogenized.
Yeah, there's certainly a worry that the world is becoming everywhere the same. For what it's worth, I'm not at all sure that it is. I think there are various things to do with our technology in particular that lead us to feel like the world is becoming everywhere the same, but it's an illusion. And by technology, I mean things like the way we all use the same online mapping apps. You know, we go to faraway countries, but we're still using Google Maps.
Right.
We're still logging into the same websites.
Yep.
I think this gives us the sense that the world is more homogenous than actually it really is. I still think there's tons of stuff I don't know about the world. And as soon as you go out into it, you're reminded of that.
Now, there's many people we could talk about that are in your book, and you write extensively about quite a number of philosophers. But there's one in particular I want to talk about, Henry Moore.
Yes.
I'd never heard of him until I read your book. I'd never heard of him. And what a fascinating person. He thought deeply about space. Now, when you were talking about space, we're not talking about outer space. What are we talking about?
We're talking about space as in space and time. It's the space between the sides of a box, that kind of space.
What time period are we talking about?
17th century is when Henry Moore is writing. He really begins publishing about 1640, and he's publishing for the next 40 years pretty continuously. And he thinks about space and time right from the very beginning. He's really a man obsessed. He is desperately trying to figure out what is the nature of reality. And for him, space is absolutely central to that.
But what is he saying space is? Is it space is divine?
Yeah. So Henry Moore is sitting in his armchair in Cambridge, and he's thinking to himself, what do I know about space? And he decides, well, the thing that I really know about space is that you cannot ever eliminate it from the world. So I can imagine everything in the world disappearing, planets, houses, the
right,
stars.
Right.
What I cannot imagine disappearing is space. Even if I think of the universe as being totally empty, space is still left behind. And he thinks to himself, well, that must mean that space is infinite and unchanging, and it must be kind of immortal in a sense.
So is space
get rid of it?
Is space God?
Yeah, exactly. And the only other thing that fits all of these qualities is God. So Henry Moore concludes space must be God's presence in the universe, and he uses
That's a wild idea.
It is a wild idea. I agree. It's a wild idea, but once he catches it by the horns, he uses it as the basis of a metaphysic. So he thinks that God is literally identical with space and time. And he uses that to explain how God creates the universe. How does God create all the stuff in it? Well, in a sense, God's creating things in his own presence.
So how does this affect people looking at landscapes? Like, this is what's fascinating to me, and you trace this really well in the book. So big, wild, remote spaces, it's the presence of God is what you're looking at.
Yeah, absolutely. As soon as you're looking at big open spaces, near infinite spaces, like mountainscapes or seascapes, they become divine in the eyes of artists and novelists and later philosophers. So what you find is that very early writing before the mid-17th century sees things like mountains as ugly, protuberances on the earth. And then a little bit later, by the early to mid-18th century, once Henry Moore's ideas have filtered through, partly by the fact they were taken up by Newton, who was so influential, and that suddenly all these artists have got on board, and you find mountains described as cathedrals to God. There's this complete revolution in the way we think about these seemingly barren landscapes. And of course, as soon as people think about mountains differently, they want to travel there. Like, so this philosophy of space, it inspired mountain tourism.
Alpine tourism caused by Henry Moore. Now, the thing is, this is really this whole sort of idea of space representing the divine. That seems to be the thing that was fueling the Romantics too, like the poets and the painters.
Yeah, I think there are definitely big connections there. I do, and with this idea of the sublime as well.
I think most people do not know the correct definition of that word, and I think it's terribly misused today.
I think that's likely true. I mean, word uses change over time, but certainly the technical meaning of sublime is a kind of feeling of pleasurable terror.
Wow. So
in that case, in that sense of the word, you might look at a huge towering mountain and say, gosh, that's sublime. You're finding a pleasurable terror in the idea the mountain might crush you. It's not crushing you, but it might.
Well, the example you give in your book, and I thought this was a really good one, was about an avalanche. So if you're looking at a painting of an avalanche, you're not experiencing the sublime. If you're in the avalanche, that's terror. If you're like in a Swiss chalet looking fairly close, but you're still not going to get swept away, that's sublime.
Yeah, absolutely. The pleasurable terror is standing close, but not too close to the source.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Emily Thomas. She's associate professor in philosophy at Durham University, and we're talking about her new book. It's a wonderful read, The Meaning of Travel, Philosophers Abroad. So we have this sense of aesthetics and this interesting word called the sublime, which I don't know what people are using it totally differently today. One of the strangest philosophers that you quoted of many is Kant. The men should be sublime, but women should be beautiful. What an ass. What an ass. What did he mean by that?
I could not agree more.
I know.
What Kant is trying to say is that men should be the source of pleasurable terror. I think he's thinking of, you know, great men, great geniuses who are so powerful that they inspire the feeling of sublime in us. But women, on the other hand, should never inspire such feelings. Women should merely be beautiful, you know, that they're to be looked at and enjoyed. They're certainly not supposed to inspire terror in others.
What a sexist jerk.
I know. I mean, Kant was horribly sexist and racist. In fact, some people argue that Kant was the first person to articulate a philosophy of racism. So, of course, racism was very common, but he was the first person to explain and justify it.
Wow. I want to stay on this idea of the sublime, because I know that feeling. I do know. I know that I have experienced that. But the popularity of this idea at the time sparks this interest in traveling to remote wild places. So are people going there just to like have that that internal experience. So there's they start building chalets with the kind of view that would give you a sublime experience.
I think they really are. I mean, novels like Frankenstein just embody this idea of traveling to these sublime landscapes, and people just really got on board. So what you see during the sort of 18th, 19th century is lots of literature around this, describing craggy precipices,
right.
And the dark, growling seas, they're standing on the shores. I mean, it just captured people's imagination. And for what it's worth, I absolutely think people are still traveling for the sublime today. When you look at people who are going shark cave diving, for example, it's like you want to be up close and personal with the sharks enough to be scared, but not actually so close that you're at risk. But I think this is very much the same idea that people are after. Some researchers have even argued that's at the heart of trips to Chernobyl now, that you want to be close to the destruction, but not temporarily too close.
It's funny, you always want that safety net.
Yes, you do. Absolutely. Otherwise, it's just not fun.
Otherwise, it's just terror.
Yes.
Yeah. You mentioned John Muir, the American environmentalist, and the writings of John Muir are filled with ideas about sublime.
They really are. He writes beautifully, and so many of his writings are about looking over craggy cliffs, and the rocks were rearing up from the sea like teeth. And he very much seems to just be on board with this and to be looking for it in his nature tracks.
Again, the idea that's central to this is that the universe is mightier than we are. It's that realization that we're a tiny speck in a very big universe, that huge powers are going on back and forth, which explains why movies about comets hitting the Earth and about all sorts of other disasters happening are so popular.
I think that's true. I think it's always good for us to be reminded, actually, of how big and powerful the universe is in comparison to us. I mean, I think right now we're being reminded of that a little bit too much.
But what's amazing about it is it's a very tiny thing. It's microscopic. So it's easy to feel the sublime with these big dramatic landscapes and the ocean. But we're feeling the terror from something we can't see. And that's is it sublime or is it just terror?
I think in this particular case, it's just terror. But perhaps in the future, when there's enough distance, the kind of thing people might want to think about in a sublime way. I mean, Irish philosopher Edmund Burke really popularized the notion of this sublime in the 18th century. And Burke catalogues sources of the sublime, and he includes many things that are not big landscape things. So, for example, he includes things like old stone monuments and howling beasts and snakes. So it doesn't necessarily have to be a big thing to be sublime.
What's wonderful is that you actually extend this idea of the sublime into the future. You talk about science fiction and examples of the sublime in sort of science fiction film, and I thought you picked a great example. The film Arrival, the 2016 film, that's a perfect example of that, where these huge ships that we don't understand land. You don't quite see the aliens clearly. They're talking something very complicated, and it really is the sense that there's something very large and much larger than us going on, and we barely have a handle on it.
I think that's right. So Edmund Burke thinks that to be sublime, something has to be partly unknown, mysterious. Mm. And you see that in lots of horror movies. The source of the horror is never quite revealed. You see shadows, but you never see the full thing. And that is exactly what's going on in that movie Arrival. I think they capture it perfectly.
Now, you weave your story of Alaska in and out of this. I love how the fact you start dreaming about being in a cabin in the woods and having that sublime experience. And then you say, Google cabin porn. Don't Google cabin porn, because I did that based on your book.
Oh dear, really?
And you know what it is? It's cabin porn. It's not.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
It's a lot of porn happening in a cabin. Like when you hang up, actually, like take the blinders off your computer And it's really funny. Eventually, you'll get to the cabin porn you're talking to if you hit a couple of subcategories. But for the time being, it's a lot of porn happening in cabins, which apparently are people experiencing the sublime.
That's good to know. Perhaps you need to Google it with the safe sex settings on.
Oh, my God. I was actually surprised and then fascinated. This also then eventually leads to the idea of wilderness. And you have a great discussion of Ralph Waldo Emerson and Henry David Thoreau Thoreau's book of Walden. How would you differentiate Emerson's God from Thoreau's God?
So both these philosophers are trying to find the fundamental nature of wilderness, if you like. And they have a lot in common. They're both advocating wandering out alone into various wilderness areas. The difference between them is that Emerson thinks that nature is somehow a reflection or a representation of God. So nature itself isn't really divine, but it's kind of an indication of how God is. And in contrast, Thoreau just thinks nature is divine, that this isn't some mere shadow or reflection. This is it. When you're looking at the wilderness, you are looking at God. And that, I think, creates a big difference between them in their attitudes to wilderness. And that comes through in the way that Thoreau is so adamant we must protect wilderness. Because if you think that this is really literally God you're protecting, then of course you should protect it at all costs.
Emerson's God is transcendent. And this is from your book. Thoreau's God is immanent. And that's actually a Christian versus pagan idea of the divine.
Yes. Yeah, or at least there are Christian immanent gods, but they're a lot fewer in number than there are if the transcendent kinds. Agreed.
One of the important ideas that comes out of Walden is the idea of solitude. Why is solitude important for us to self-understanding?
So Thoreau thinks that it's really only by being alone in nature that we can soak it up. And certainly the passages where he writes about being solitary in nature are just stunning. There are pages about how he watches the ice crack and fracture on Walden Pond, and they're really beautiful. And you are persuaded that this is not something he would have been able to absorb in the same way if he'd been with other people.
Now, that said, the jury's still divided about Thoreau.
Yes, very much so. Some people really dislike him. If you Google it's funny because
I covered years ago, I forget who the woman's name was, but she wrote a very definitive biography of Thoreau. And he was a bit of a prig. It was like, and his mother was still doing his laundry or something like that. Is that true?
This is something he has been crucified for.
Well, yeah, I'm living this dramatic life alone in the woods, but mom still does the laundry?
Yes. To be fair to him, he never claims to be totally isolated. But that is, isn't he talks in the book about meeting other people, but nonetheless, there is the impression of, you know, he's living by himself in the woods, he built his own cabin, and yet, when you discover that he's taking his laundry to his family, it just seems like a tremendous betrayal.
Plus the fact, didn't he sneak out of the cabin periodically and go to town?
Some people think so, yeah. I mean, he really is open about meeting with people on walks and going to visit with people in the book. But I suspect he was doing it more frequently than he describes.
So what's your feeling of Thoreau, personally? This is off your academic writing, but this is just a personal idea about Thoreau. What's your feeling about Thoreau?
Actually, I'm a fan. I really am. I find the writing about nature so captivating. Okay. I'm willing to forgive him an awful lot.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah.
Now, and finally, we just have a few minutes left. We were talking before about tourism versus travel and then the idea of the sublime. It seems to me today it's incredibly tough to get a true sublime experience while you're traveling because everything has been so commercially geared now that you expect it. And by expecting it, like, does the sublime have to be a surprise?
No, I don't think the sublime does have to be surprising. I think if you know that there's a crest of a mountain coming up, that's not going to affect whether or not it becomes a source of the sublime for you. I will say, certainly, tourism is just increasing and increasing, so it can feel like it's harder to get away from the tourist masses, but it is absolutely still possible. I really think, without a shadow of a doubt, it is. It's just a bit harder now than it was before. And I think the traditional tourist sites, that's just increasingly difficult, just as there are so many more people. But just go off the beaten trail. I think there is still so much planet left to discover.
Well, you know, it's interesting because commercial space travel seems to be on the horizon. And it's funny watching people like line up to take a space flight. And I get a distinct sense that it's the desire to sort of experience the ultimate in sublime.
I would do it.
Would you?
Yeah, absolutely. If it was affordable for the masses, I would absolutely be looking to do that. The idea of seeing our planet from a totally new perspective, it is so appealing. I would be on that spaceship.
Well, you know, I think it's important to send a philosopher into space, and I'm not kidding, because I think philosophers, more than anybody else, are able to think deeply about the experience and then put it in writing.
I really hope that that's true. Yeah. And I definitely.
So get your name on that list, Emily. You need to go up into space.
I strongly support this plan.
Okay. My guest tonight has been Emily Thomas. She's associate professor in philosophy at Durham University. And we've been talking about a new book, is just wonderful read, The Meaning of Travel, Philosophers Abroad. Emily, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. This has been lovely.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.